This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. So how much does where we live influence our politics? Does living in an East Coast city or on the Midwestern plains or at the foot of the Rockies or near a port on the West Coast affect our view of the law and the role of government? Looking at election maps, you can see how geography does make a difference. Our guest, Akhil Reed Amar, has written his third book about the U.S. Constitution. This one is called The Law of the Land, a grand tour of our constitutional republic. Amar is our tour guide through our constitutional history. He says Abraham Lincoln's Midwestern upbringing influenced his views on slavery and the Union. The Second Amendment means something very different in Wyoming than it does in Philadelphia, especially suburban Philadelphia. And one of his chapters is about Lord Camden in New Jersey, who's been overshadowed by William Penn and his contributions to federalism. Akhil Reed Amar is the Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. It's been a number of years, and nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You begin with Abraham Lincoln, and, you know, why not? Our most consequential president. How did his growing up in the Midwest, how did that influence his view of government, of politics, civil war, secession?
So you're right. I do begin with Lincoln. He's my hero. This is the 150th anniversary to the season of the end of the Civil War and his death. And we live in his house. The framers built a house that was divided against itself because of slavery. It had this uneven foundation. And he rebuilt it, gave us a new birth of freedom. And the two biggest decisions ever probably in our constitutional tradition are his decision to resist secession and ultimately to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which will lead to a 13th Amendment ending slavery. So on secession, he's an American and not just a state person. Hmm. Robert E. Lee from Virginia, and Robert E. Lee thinks, of course, Virginia comes first. The Lees have been running Virginia since the 1620s, generation after generation of Lee. But now Abraham Lincoln, he's born in Kentucky. His father's from Virginia. His grandfather's from Pennsylvania. Before that, they think they're from New England, although he doesn't quite know which state. He moves to Indiana as a young man, then to Illinois. He's a modern American. And why do they move from Kentucky to Indiana? Well, they move to Indiana because Indiana is free soil, because the federal government has set up good land grant, land surveys in Indiana. When they're in Kentucky, they're working the land, but they're not quite sure they really own it because some other speculator claims he's got a right to it. So they move to the free soil of Indiana, which is set up by the federal government. The federal government created Indiana and Illinois, and the federal government had a commitment to public education in these places, which is going to be the moral land grant for Lincoln. The federal government made these places free soil. The language of the Northwest Ordinance, which is even older than the Constitution, which says there's no slavery in the Northwest, is going to be places like they'll become Indiana and Illinois and Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin. That's going to be word for word the language of the 13th Amendment, borrowed directly from the Northwest Ordinance.
Which is why he believed in the Union and opposed secession probably for a whole host of reasons, but believed, I guess, in the primacy of the federal government?
He says that the Union created the state, which is a very edgy claim. I'm not sure it's right, but it's a very distinctively Northwestern claim. It's a claim from someone from the Midwest and not so much from Virginia. He's a free soil person because he comes from this part of the country. More generally, the title of the book, The Law of the Land, is a reference to the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which Lincoln also emphasizes. He says, listen, South Carolina, what part of the Constitution do you not understand? The Constitution is always and everywhere the supreme law of the land, no ifs, ands, or buts. If you don't like it, you're free to leave individually, but you can't take the land with you. And the reason is there's no defensible border between southern Illinois and Arkansas or Missouri or Kentucky or Tennessee. It's just flat in the middle of the country. And all of our goods from the Rockies to the Appalachians, they actually float, they drain through the Mississippi River. We can't get our goods to market without going through New Orleans. We can't let you basically take the Mississippi away from us, take the Southland away from us. That's all American land that we all fought for. It's the law of the land. And so he mentions all of that too. And it's a very Midwestern point of view, because if you're trying to get your goods to market in Illinois, you've got to go down the Mississippi River.
Well, as you seem to be saying, and I think you write in the book, is that from Lincoln's perspective, the nation created the states. You mentioned Robert E. Lee, that the states created the nation. Two very different worldviews,
yes.
I guess, reflecting both their experiences, what, North and South,
yes.
but also their own
families and
family
and identities.
Would it be also fair, even going back to the beginning, the writing of the U.S. Constitution, even our secession from England, 3,000 miles separated the colonies from the mother country. Whether, if we're talking about geography, whether that also had something to do with the creation of this country?
Oh, hugely. The framers, now note that when the framers announced their independence at this place called Independence Hall, right down the street from us, they are repudiating a regime that none of them voted for. They didn't vote for the king. They didn't vote for a parliament. And so that's very different than what South Carolina is going to try to do in the 1860s. And note second that the framers at Philadelphia came up with good reasons, because the king and parliament were doing all sorts of unfair, indeed tyrannical things, whereas the South wasn't able to come up with a good reason except for slavery. But the third thought that the founders have is, yes, we're naturally kind of our own people. There's 3,000 miles that separate us from Great Britain. And if we can form our own regime, we'll have a huge moat that protects us in the same way that England's protected by the English Channel. We'll have 3,000 miles of water between us and the tyrannies of the old world. And America is free for most of its history. Not so much because of the Bill of Rights, which is what we tell our students, or judicial review, but for the first 150 years after independence, there is no standing army of any significance in peacetime in America. So America is very free because we don't have bordering regimes that really can threaten us. We are able to basically hold our own against the Canadians and defeat the Mexicans and with the Louisiana Purchase, which is going to lead to the Northwest Ordinance. Which is going to lead to the expansion into the Midwest. We've kicked out, in effect, the old powers of Europe, gotten France out and Spain out and Britain out. And so no one messes with us because we've got this land, this hemisphere, largely to ourselves for most of our national experience. And Lincoln understands all of that.
As you mentioned, we had, sort of written and baked into our governance, slavery. Mm-hmm. You also write that from the early on, the presidents were either slave owners or they were men of the North with Southern sympathies.
Lincoln is the first openly anti-slavery president. He doesn't say he's going to get rid of slavery immediately. He just says it's wrong and we should eventually get rid of it. And before Lincoln, not a single previous president even says that. Not a single cabinet officer even says that. And you have some ridiculously pro-slavery types in the cabinet, like John C. Calhoun from South Carolina. And you might say, well, Professor, what about John Quincy Adams? I saw this movie, The Amistad, and he's anti-slavery.
Right.
That's only after he's no longer president, when he only has to appeal to a Massachusetts electorate because he's a congressman from Massachusetts, old man eloquent against slavery. As president, his vice president is John C. Calhoun from South Carolina. That's John Quincy Adams. His dad, when he runs for president, John Adams, his vice presidential running mate is also a South Carolinian. You can't get elected president in the early republic and be emphatically anti-slavery. But by 1860, you can. Lincoln just barely does it. He sweeps the North, except for New Jersey. He loses in every southern state. In fact, he gets zero popular vote south of Virginia. So it's a sharp geographic schism.
I mean, kind of red state, blue state, as we think of it today?
Lincoln wins almost every state that Obama won, and Lincoln loses almost every state that Obama lost. But the interesting thing, of course, is that the latest tall, skinny constitutional lawyer from Illinois is a Democrat, not a Republican. So the parties have basically flipped in 150 years. But it's the same lineup, state by state, in the election of 1860 and the election of 2012. Yeah, or 12. Right. Yeah, both.
Well, but what's interesting is obviously we're a very different country than we were 100 or 200 years ago, and a much more mobile country. Maybe live more like Lincoln than Robert E. Lee, because people move all over the place. Mm-hmm. They have families scattered across the country, and yet there seem to be these divisions.
Yes, and I shouldn't overstate, because even the bluest state isn't 100% blue, and even the reddest state isn't 100% red. But here's something that's really interesting. We are living in a world in which, at least recently, the North has voted against the South in the last six presidential elections, and that happened in the 1850s, but it didn't happen before Lincoln's era, 1850s. It didn't happen, you know, before the last six presidential elections. Bill Clinton got support North and South, and so did Ronald Reagan, and so did Jimmy Carter, and so did Lyndon Johnson. But in the last six, the North and the South have really divided much more, as they did in the 1850s. And there are not so many swing states. In the last election, only four states were decided by less than five percentage points. And they're where North meets South. And three of them, they're geographically where North meets South. And one, it's demographically because of movement of people. So Ohio and Virginia and North Carolina were three of the close states last time. There are only four. Hmm. But the other one, and that's where North meets South. Ohio is where North meets South. And Virginia is because D.C. has kind of expanded demographically, and even North Carolina. But the fourth is metaphorically where North meets South, but not quite geographically. It's Florida, because all these New Jersey and New York retirees have moved down to Florida and kind of made it purpley.
So does that just say that these early divisions continue? Are we talking gerrymandering, which sort of has highlighted how certain people can get elected to office and maintain their position in government?
So all of the above. History matters. So the states, their boundaries have been fixed. They haven't been gerrymandering,
right.
Gerrymandered. And we have the legacy of, frankly, sort of slavery and race in America. The culture of cotton was very different than the culture of corn. And that's the division between North and South that Lincoln talks about. And we still see some of that today. Within states, we also have movements in which cities are becoming increasingly blue and rural areas increasingly red. And that's happening in states like Pennsylvania, for example. And then politicians do try to draw districts in ways that advantage either incumbents or political parties or both. There's sometimes a tension between those. So all of the above.
And that's Akhil Reed Amar, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called The Law of the Land, and it's subtitled A Grand Tour of Our Constitutional Republic, and he teaches at Yale University. And we are talking about the role of, I guess, geography in describing the various points of view that we have about government, that we have about the Constitution, amendments like the Second Amendment. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Send us an email. I had to think about that. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Akhil Reed Amar. He's a professor at Yale University, and he writes in his new book, The Law of the Land, that geography has mattered when it comes to the writers and interpreters of the U.S. Constitution, and apparently it matters even today as we think about the difference between those bright red states and those bright blue states. And again, to join us, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So I'm thinking of from Texas, we have, I mean, some of these are declared, some not declared. Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Rick Perry wanting to run for, looks like they want to run for president. Elizabeth Warren, everyone's pushing her, but she doesn't want to. But we've got Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who just tossed his hat in the ring, if I can use a cliche here. So when you see even those people that want to run for president, apparently there are going to be some more announcements this week. How do you interpret that? How do you see that geographically speaking?
So there are three different chapters actually that connect to presidential succession and selection. And one is about Florida and one is about Ohio. But the third one is actually about Texas, which looms very large. In FDR's coalition, Texas was a key part of the Democrat base. His vice president was John Nance Garner. And Jack Kennedy needs Lyndon Johnson, the Boston-Austin axis. But since Lyndon Johnson, basically, there's been a realignment, and Texas has been pretty much lost to the Democrats. Jimmy Carter won it the first time in 76, but got blown out in 1980. And Texas is a huge part of the Republican coalition. In six of the last nine presidential elections, Republicans have had a Texan on the ballot, and five of the six times that when they've run a Texan, they've won. Every time they've not run a Texan, they haven't won. So we've got Rick Perry, who's was a governor of Texas for more than 12 years. We got Rand Paul, who's born in Texas and whose father from Texas ran for president multiple times. We got Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, but let's not also forget Jeb Bush,
sure,
born in Texas, educated in Texas, the brother and the son of people who ran for the presidency and won from Texas. Bush also, of course, has Florida, which is key. Now, from a regional point of view, you see there are four basic regions of the country, conventionally, the East, the South, the Midwest, and the West. Hillary Clinton's a regional triple threat. She's born in the Midwest from Lincoln's, Illinois. She's the first lady of the South, Arkansas. She's a senator from the East, New York, and she went to school in the East, Yale Law School and Wellesley. So she's a regional triple threat. Her only weakness is the far West, but that's where Chelsea went to school, and she's got that covered. Now, take Mitt Romney. Contrary-wise, he's a regional triple threat too. He was born in Michigan, Midwest, connections to Utah and the West, also governor of Massachusetts East. But he's not a Southerner, and today's Republican Party is deeply Southern, and that made it awkward for Mitt Romney. He just couldn't quite connect to Southerners in a way that Marco Rubio can, or Ted Cruz can, or Jeb Bush can, and so now you're beginning to see how these things play out. But I also talk about and this has gone under the radar screen. We haven't noticed it. We've noticed dynasty and other things, but let's look at where these folks went to school. Our last four presidents all went to Harvard or Yale or both. Five of the last seven runners-up went to Harvard or Yale or both. If we include vice presidents in the mix and people running for president, the last time that we didn't have someone from Harvard or Yale on the ballot as one of the four finalists, the two presidential candidates and the two vice presidential candidates, 1968.
Wow.
And in 20...
That'd be Nixon, right?
Yes, who got into Harvard but couldn't go there for family financial reasons when he was a youngster. In 20 of the last 28 presidential elections, you've had someone on the ballot, either the president or the loser, the runner-up, the guy who ran from the other party and lost. In 20 of the last 28 presidential elections, in 20 of those 28, you've had someone from either Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or Columbia, or more than one of those on the ballot.
And how about if you look at the U.S. Supreme Court, aren't they all Ivy League grads then?
Six from Harvard Law School, three from Yale Law School. They all went to fancy colleges. And that's not Abe Lincoln. That's not actually one of my favorite justices. I profile him as a guy from the South named Hugo Black, who didn't have a fancy education. This is what's happening in the modern world. Increasingly, you have to go to certain fancy educational institutions, typically Ivy League institutions, typically New England institutions, in order to get the proper credentials.
But out of that, you get a Scalia and you get a Ginsburg, who have very different views of the U.S. Constitution.
So geography isn't destiny.
No.
In the same state, no state is 100% blue or red. So, and yet, they do reflect their upbringings in interesting ways. You can see the way in which Clarence Thomas is a Southerner in the same way that Hugo Black was a Southerner, even though Clarence Thomas is a conservative and Hugo Black was a liberal.
You do write about Justice Kennedy, and all eyes seem to be on Justice Kennedy because he has become the swing vote on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yep.
He's a California Republican. Now, what should we make of the fact that he has those connections?
You should remember that I began by saying we live in Lincoln's house, and there used to be lots of Lincoln Republicans. There are not so many anymore because of this regional realignment that I've been talking about. The Republican Party has become the party of the former Confederacy to some extent. But in my lifetime, there was this famous Lincoln Republican, and his name was Earl Warren. And
sure.
He's from Sacramento, California. And who's growing up in Sacramento when Earl Warren is governor? A young man named Anthony Kennedy. Earl Warren visits the Kennedy household on multiple occasions. Kennedy is a legislative page in Sacramento looking up to this Lincoln Republican. And he's appointed by another California Republican, Ronald Reagan. But Kennedy is kind of part Ronald Reagan, part Earl Warren, you see. And today's court, we call it the Roberts Court, but in fact, it's pretty much the Kennedy Court. Kennedy is almost always in the majority, except for the Affordable Care Act case, right. The Obamacare case. But apart from that, he's almost always in the majority. So we live in the Kennedy Court. And I think he sees himself as very much in an Earl Warren tradition. He's a Lincoln Republican. In a way that Earl Warren was, and you had some that kind of got pushed out of the party. That's Arlen Specter. That's Jim Jeffords from Vermont. That's Lincoln Chaffee,
yes.
From Rhode Island on the Supreme Court. It was these Northern Republicans: David Souter from New Hampshire, John Paul Stevens from Chicago, Harry Blackmun from Minnesota. But in national politics, elective politics, not so many Lincoln Republicans anymore.
Picking up on what you just said about Kennedy, is there any way then to predict how he's going to rule or where he's going to sit when it comes to gay marriage?
Well, I have a chapter on Kennedy, and I grew up in just down the road in Northern California, just down the road from Justice Kennedy, and I admire him. And I don't think it's a total coincidence that the one Republican appointee on the court who most gets it on gay rights grew up in Northern California, which is renowned for its respect for alternative lifestyles. The chapter profiles the only three really major gay rights victories in the Supreme Court. Anthony Kennedy wrote for the court all three times: Romer versus Evans in 1996-97, Lawrence versus Texas in 2003, and then a couple of terms ago in the Windsor case, the case about the Defense of Marriage Act. So three times the court has ruled emphatically in favor of gay rights. Every time Justice Kennedy has written for the court, and Justice Scalia has written an over-the-top dissent. And these are two appointees of Ronald Reagan, but they have different perspectives.
But you're saying Kennedy's roots in Northern California, which is a little more counterculture than the rest of the country, that is sort of embedded in his thinking?
I speculate. You know, we can't be – I don't know why I do certain things. We don't – you know, human motivation is very deep and complex, but – isn't it interesting that this guy who grows up in the shadow of Earl Warren talked this last week about Brown versus Board of Education, decided by Earl Warren, also profiled in the book, and talked about Loving versus Virginia, the miscegenation case, also written by Earl Warren? That's what he said. And it's the second thing I think he said was, well, there was 10 years between Brown and Loving. Brown is 54. Actually, Loving is 67. He said about, you know, a decade.
Yeah.
And that's about the same amount of time that we've had same-sex marriage. And so he, in his head, is like thinking about himself vis-a-vis Earl Warren, I think vis-a-vis Abraham Lincoln, the leader of his nominal party. Yes, I think he sees himself as connected to this national narrative and through Warren to Northern California. He's got a libertarian streak and an egalitarian streak, and that's California Republicans.
And that's Akhil Reed Amar, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And we are talking about some of what he has written in his new book. It's called The Law of the Land, A Grand Tour of Our Constitutional Republic. He's written a couple of books about the U.S. Constitution, including America's Constitution and America's Unwritten Constitution. And he's a Sterling Professor of Law and political science at Yale University. He told me before the show began that he went there as an undergraduate, and he has not left since. We have some emails, and you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. I do want to put something else on the table before we go to our listeners. You write a really fascinating chapter about the Second Amendment. And I mean, there's always that sort of analysis, like what were they saying when they wrote this sentence with the funny commas here and there? Yes, exactly. But your take on it is so interesting, which is that when you look at it through the lens of, I guess, Wyoming, it has a different cast than if you were to look at it through the lens of, let's say, Massachusetts or something like that.
My big theme is that the Constitution is an intergenerational document. Yes, it begins in Philadelphia. But there are all these amendments, and the amendments are transformative. Lincoln's generation adds a 13th, 14th, and 15th amendment, and in the process of doing that, transforms the meaning of the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights originally applies only against the states, but thanks to Lincoln's generation, it applies against originally it applies only against the federal government, but thanks to Lincoln's generation, now it applies against the states. And in the course of thinking about the Bill of Rights applying against the states, Lincoln's generation reinterprets it. The founding, maybe they're interested in militias and Lexington and Concord and Bunker's Hill, and they're worried about the king's soldiers. But by Lincoln's generation, they're thinking about blacks needing to have guns in their homes for self-protection because they can't count on the cops to protect them when the Klan comes calling. So Lincoln's generation reinterprets the Second Amendment in the course of making it applicable against the states. A 19th Amendment is going to come along and actually make women part of the project. And when we talk about the 14th Amendment and the 19th Amendment, we're talking not about Massachusetts and the East Coast and Philadelphia. We're talking about the Midwest. We're talking about Wyoming when it kind of starts to enter the conversation. And so it turns out Wyoming is interested in cowboys, but also Wyoming is interested in cowgirls, and it's interested in women's equality. And people in Wyoming, actually, they have the they're the first state to give women the vote, and they're the first state to have a woman governor. They call themselves the cowboy state, but also the equality state. And I think that Wyoming perspective suggests actually that women should be part of our force structure, our modern-day militias, which are police departments and the army. So it's a very complex story. I've actually summarized an awful lot in just the last minute or so. But the individual rights dynamic of the Second Amendment is influenced by the 14th and 19th in Wyoming, and so is the collective military aspects of the Second Amendment influenced by later developments, especially women's equality.
Well, and if I could add to that, I'm assuming, 150 years ago, living in what was Wyoming or what became Wyoming, it was all men and women on deck. It was about survival. It was about farming. It was about ranching. And you couldn't make these divisions between, this was women's work and that was men's work. Everyone had to work together.
And the men were actually desperate to get women because when Wyoming Territory is a territory first, just like Indiana and Illinois. And as a territory, in 1870, there are 6 white men for every white woman in Wyoming, and the men are actually desperate. And so they say, how do we get women to come to Wyoming? And so one of them says, I know this is crazy, but suppose we listened to them. and they say they want the suffrage, the vote, and they say they want equal pay for equal work. And in 1870, Wisconsin says, we'll give you both. You come to Wyoming, and you will be able to vote and serve on juries, by the way, and also get equal pay for equal work. That's 1870, but it's created in part by the territorial circumstances of many men and not so many women in Wyoming. So that's an interesting story.
So how do you interpret a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed?
2 different aspects.
Okay.
There's a collective aspect. It's about sort of militias and military, and the basic idea is the militia should be the people. Those who vote, the people, we the people, do ordain and establish the Constitution, should pretty much be the same folks that bear arms. Our armies should look like America. They shouldn't be a military-industrial complex that's a culture within a culture. So the collective dimension would be our police forces, which are like modern-day militias, and our armies should should be representative just like our Congress should. So men and women, gays and straights, blacks and whites, that's the collective dimension. We should tell the Army what to do and they should look like us. That's relevant to Baltimore or to Ferguson or to Colin Powell heading up, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's the collective dimension. The individual dimension, which is after the Civil War, because the framers were talking about militias, but after the Civil War, there's an idea that that individuals may need guns in their homes for self-protection, especially blacks down south. The National Rifle Association, the NRA, is founded after the Civil War by ex-Union Army officers, and they think people have to have a gun, a right at least, to have a gun in their home for self-protection because they can't count on the local constables to protect them when the Klan comes calling. So two different features of the Second Amendment, an individual right component added especially or reinforced by Lincoln's generation in the after the Civil War, and a collective component also changed by later amendments, because once women become voters, they should become soldiers and police officers and jurors and senators and, dare I say it, presidents.
Well, we're almost having a break here. What I hear you saying, and perhaps from your own perspective, is that then people should have a right to own a gun to protect themselves in their home.
They do. I don't have one. It's not a, you know, but I think our constitutional tradition clearly supports that. And by the way, that right is in many state constitutions as well. And this is a book all about federalism. So even if the federal constitution said nothing about it, it would be an unenumerated right, as is privacy, that we can see reflected in many state constitutions, as we see the right of privacy reflected in state constitutions.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Akhil Reed Amar. He has a new book. It's called The Law of the Land, A Grand Tour of Our Constitutional Republic. And he's a professor at Yale University, joining us in this hour of Radio Times, talking about the importance of geography, topography, when it comes to our understanding of government, of the U.S. Constitution, of laws, and of even things like the Second Amendment. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. I will be reading some emails, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and if you're just joining us, Akhil Reed Amar is our guest. We're talking about his third book about the Constitution, the first one called America's Constitution, then America's Unwritten Constitution, and this one called The Law of the Land. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You wanted to read something about Wyoming.
Yeah,
something, I guess, Wyoming maybe said about itself.
Yes, this is from a Cheyenne, Wyoming newspaper in 1870. Once they've just voted 1869, they've just voted to let women vote in Wyoming. The men have voted to let the women vote. And here's what the newspaper said. "We now expect at once quite an immigration of ladies to Wyoming. We say to them all, come on." They're not
That's
subtle.
Great.
They're
no.
not subtle.
No,
if
they're from Wyoming.
If you've seen Paint Your Wagon, you know, the men are desperate for the women.
Yeah. You said we were talking about this before going on the air about guns in Wyoming. You think there should be both sex education and gun education in schools.
Right. I wrote a book called The Unwritten Constitution. They're unenumerated rights, what goes around comes around. They shouldn't be different for liberals and conservatives. Liberals say, well, we believe in privacy. We believe in sex in the home. And conservatives say, well, we want guns in the home. I say, give them both what they want. You know, this is America. We have to be tolerant. People want to have guns. Okay. I don't want to have one in my house, but, you know, my wife would kill me if I said something about sex in our home, so I will not. Liberals believe in sex education in schools. Conservatives believe in gun education. I actually believe in both. Both can kill you if you don't know what you're doing. You know, there are sexually transmitted diseases. There are AIDS. Kids need to know what a gun looks like so they don't pick it up and just start pointing it at folks. So I actually do think we should have both gun education and sex education in the schools. Unenumerated rights in America come in part from the states. Let's actually look at state constitutions where you see protections of sexual privacy and you see protections of guns.
Do you think we ever, though, will resolve and come to some consensus on what the Second Amendment actually says? We did a show a couple of months ago, and one of our guests said, this is the worst conversation I've ever heard. I mean, we get stuck with these conversations from people from such different camps.
So I say, suppose the Second Amendment didn't exist at all, I'd still believe in a right to have a gun in the home for self-protection because it's part of our American tradition. And by the way, again, I don't own a gun, but there are almost as many guns as there are humans in America. Trying to actually get rid of them would make prohibition look like a walk in the park. So they're here, and we have to get used to them. I say the same about my gay friends, you see. So I'm trying to actually get conservatives and liberals to realize that perhaps there are possibilities for understanding where the other is coming from.
Let me read an email from Jim. He says, the point is always made that Lincoln was a Republican, the party of Lincoln. Isn't it the nature of parties themselves that have flipped? There may be more similarities between the Republican Party of Lincoln's time and that of today, but mostly it's very different from then. The Southern Democrats of the Civil Rights era virtually all became Republican conservatives, didn't they?
Exactly.
And
there's
some truth to that.
Exactly. Yes. So that's the realignment that occurs after 1965. I talk about it very briefly in the book, and in a nutshell, Lyndon Johnson, the presidency has been dominated by Southerners in the early period. Lincoln is the first anti-slavery president, and the South misbehaves. It takes up arms against a duly elected president, and we don't have another president from the South elected, you know, for the next 100 years after they've dominated the presidency. Woodrow Wilson runs as a New Jersey guy, as a Princeton guy, even though he's basically Southern, but he doesn't run that way. Lyndon Johnson comes along. He's a Texan. He gets a Southerner and Westerner. He gets through the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and then there's a massive realignment.
Right.
Blacks in the South join the Democrat Party because Lyndon Johnson got this done. They push out of the party. In effect, conservative whites in the South bolt from the Democratic Party. They used to be Democrats, 60 Crats. They become Republicans. They push the Republican Party hard to the right and therefore push out of the party all the Rockefeller, New England, Northeastern Republicans like Arlen Specter, like Lincoln Chaffee, like Jim Jeffords. So the Republican Party gets pushed hard to the right, the Democratic Party hard to the left. And today we're living in a world in which there's almost complete polarization. The most conservative Democrat in Congress is still to the left. Joe Manchin
of West Virginia
is still to the left of the most liberal Republican, Olympia Snowe, on most issues. That wasn't true in the 1960s. You had very conservative Democrats, some liberal Republicans. We have a regional and a political realignment all created by Lyndon Johnson's election in 1964 as the first Southerner since Reconstruction and the Voting Rights Act of 65. So that's a geographic and political realignment.
Let me see what Chris from looks like Ottsville has to say. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'd like to speak about our education systems. I'd like to say that I think that the lack of information that is given about our sexuality and about guns and et cetera leads to misinformation and also the sterilization of our minds. I think it provides a level of ignorance that causes the playing field to be a little uneven.
Okay, Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I mean, this is a little bit off tangent. There are questions about whether it's the parents' responsibility to teach their children about guns, to teach their children about sex, or whether it's a school's sort of collective responsibility.
Well, let's add one third thing to the mix, two things to the mix. There are things called books, and kids can read them. And there are things called radio shows, and kids can listen to them. And we are part – there's a thing called the National Constitution Center across the street. And these are all parts of – so I agree with Chris that education is huge. And eventually, you see, these kids become adults, and they have to actually be able to educate themselves.
An email from R. I don't know if you can answer this. He wants to know, how does Scalia, the originalist, support guns – under the Lincoln Constitution?
In a case called Heller, where Justice Scalia wrote for the majority, he actually briefly mentioned the Reconstruction experience with guns. In fact, it was one of his best pieces of evidence, but he didn't flourish it, I think, as well as he might have, because he kept trying to tell a Second Amendment story rather than a 14th Amendment Lincoln story.
And this was the guns in Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C., Heller, 2005, I believe. Later, the court revisited the issue and actually asked, well, does this gun right apply to states and localities? That's the case called City of Chicago versus McDonald. In that one, Justice Alito wrote for the majority and emphasized all the things that I had been talking about, Lincoln's generation's vision, the Freedmen's Bureau Bill of 1866 that actually explicitly uses the words a constitutional right to bear arms in connection with an individual right, and all the Reconstruction evidence, the Lincoln-era evidence, was featured front and center by Justice Alito. He was kind enough to cite my work actually 6 times, and Justice Breyer in dissent actually cited my work as well. But Art is right. Because Justice Scalia is a certain kind of originalist, I think he misses all the – he focuses on the founding but misses all the way in which later generations added amendments that transformed and changed the original meanings in important ways.
Let's talk about Lord Camden, because as you have a chapter on him, and as you say, he has been overshadowed by William Penn,
yes,
of Pennsylvania, but his contributions, what, to Federalism?
Yes. If just as the crow flies from Independence Hall, Camden might be even closer than that William Penn statue. And it's not just Camden, New Jersey. It's Camden, South Carolina, and Camden, Maine. And the Baltimore Orioles play in Camden Yards. Sure. Actually, the cases for which Camden was most famous involved a man named Wilkes, as in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Wilkes County, Georgia. John Wilkes Booth is named after Wilkes. Ashley Wilkes in Gone with the Wind is an allusion to all of this. So who is this Camden guy? Well, he's a Brit who actually believed in American independence, as did William Pitt. And so Americans loved Camden, and they loved William Pitt. And Camden had this idea that when government misbehaves, you have to be able to sue the officers who have, for example, unreasonably searched your house or seized your private papers. And that vision has radical implications even today, because in America today, when the feds misbehave, if they unreasonably search you or seize your papers, often state law can help you get recovery against federal officials. In the same way that if the feds grabbed your land, it would be state property law that would enable you to bring a suit for just compensation, so too if the feds unreasonably search or seize you under the Fourth Amendment, it's often state law that can help you get a remedy against federal officialdom. So federalism today remains very important. This is a celebration of federalism. And even though Camden was an English guy, not really focusing on American federalism, his idea have radical implications today for how states can help keep the federal government in check in interesting ways.
I like in this chapter that you referred to New Jersey as the Rodney Dangerfield of states, but they don't get no respect. Is that what you're saying here?
Yes, and it's a little gritty. And this was a lecture that I actually originally gave at Rutgers, Camden. So Philadelphia gets all the glory, and Camden becomes the butt of some of these jokes. But Lord Camden was a very, very great man, and most Americans, even American lawyers, don't know who he was and how his ideas continue to have revolutionary implications even today.
You're a member, or I guess you've gotten an award from the Federalist Society. Are you – I mean, do you think of yourself as a Federalist?
No, I'm an Obama Democrat. But I am trying to be in conversation with my friends on the other side of the aisle. So I studied from Robert Bork, who told me, well, you have to take the Constitution's text seriously. And I'm trying to be in conversation. I'm doing an event next month with Clarence Thomas, actually later this month, with Clarence Thomas at the National Archives. I mentioned Sam Alito. I've done all sorts of events with him because what we have in common is the Constitution, whether we're liberals or conservatives or red or blue or north or south or east or west. So these books are kind of love poems of sorts to our Constitution. This is kind of Woody Guthrie, from the New York – from the Redwood Forest to the New York Island. And so I'm actually proud of the fact that I'm a liberal that's actually in conversation with conservatives.
We could do a whole hour on this, and we certainly have done whole hours on this because it goes back to 2000 and the Bush v. Gore decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. My reading of your writing is that you believe it was wrongly decided.
Yeah, I'm harshly critical of Bush versus Gore. And my friend Tony Kennedy was on the wrong side of that. No one's perfect. Now, Justice Scalia was on the wrong side of that and is still kind of saying the rest of us should get over it. I don't think that at all. If the court made a mistake, we need to understand where and why and how. And it made a mistake in part because the issues in Bush versus Gore ultimately were state law issues that should have been decided by the state judges because I believe in federalism. And federal courts can decide federal issues, but the issues actually that were decisive in Bush versus Gore properly belonged to the Florida Supreme Court, not the U.S. Supreme Court.
And correct me if I'm wrong. In the decision of Bush v. Gore, did the court also say that this could not be applied to any other future case?
Bush versus Gore was a hot mess all around. They kind of announced from the beginning, don't try this at home, other judges, this is for one day only, and that was not so good.
Let me see. We have a tweet from Colin who says, Chief Justice Roberts said last week he didn't want to outpace public opinion on gay rights. And the question Colin has, is this constitutional?
Our Constitution is a reflection to some extent of public opinion. The people elect presidents, and presidents pick justices. So the Dred Scott Court, for example, is picked by a pro-slavery president. And five of the Dred Scott's from the 1850s, five of the justices come from the slaveholding South in the 1850s, even though the slaveholding South only has a third of the free population. So our constitutional process is connected to politics because people vote for president and presidents pick justices. And now that said, there are rights and they're guaranteed in the Constitution. It says equal, and we're not supposed to quite just take a vote on equal. Equal means equal. And in 1954, that means that a third of the country is really wrong when it has de jure segregation. And that's what Earl Warren says in Brown versus Board of Education. By the way, the same states that didn't get it on segregation, they were some of the same states that didn't get it on slavery a century before. Kansas both times was on the wrong side, Bleeding Kansas in the 1850s and Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas in the 1950s. If you look at a map today, it's a similar geographic pattern on same-sex marriage. It's the same states, really, that are most resistant to same-sex marriage, and the Constitution does say equal. And Lincoln, his generation adds the 14th Amendment, and here's the first sentence of the 14th Amendment, basically. It says everyone born in America is born a citizen, and that's – we're born equal. We're created equal, whether we're born black or white, or whether we're born male or female, whether we're born Jew or Gentile. I would say whether we're born gay or straight. It's a radical idea. It's Lincoln's idea. It's a reinterpretation of Jefferson. Lincoln says, you know, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now, Jefferson said that in Philadelphia, in Independence Hall, right down the road. He said it, but he didn't live it. He didn't breathe it. He didn't mean it. Lincoln reinterprets it. And when he dies, that 14th Amendment incorporates Lincoln's reinterpretation of Jefferson. It says equal, and I think that's equal gay and straight. I think my friend Justice Kennedy probably thinks that too. We will see soon enough.
Yes, we will. And we're almost out of time here. I mean, from your perspective, is Lincoln our greatest president then?
My parents when I was a kid just once asked me, you know, whom I loved more, my mom or my dad. And I said, I love mommy the most and daddy the best. So my two are George Washington and Abe Lincoln. And don't make me choose between them. But yes, Abe Lincoln is our founding father, even though he's a later generation and a different part of the country.
On that note, Akhil Reed Amar, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me again.
You're very welcome. And again, the book is called The Law of the Land, A Grand Tour of Our Constitutional Republic. And he's a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. And Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.